Welcome to the Full of Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording, and it is 3:14 p.m. and that is Central Time. Today is March 16th, and I thought we'd kick off with the Nasdaq, where we've had a good sized rally this week, and it is popping up from the region of the 1,000-day and 200-day moving averages, and it has broken the sequence of lower rally highs. So the downtrend since the peak in 2021 has been broken. And this is about as clear evidence of demand coming back at a higher low. And in the region of the 1,000-day moving average, that's about as good evidence as one could possibly hope for. And if it continues on the upside tomorrow, then this will be an upside weekly key reversal. And of course, that does beg the question, how can this possibly be happening when the banking sector is in all kinds of strife? And there has been the number bandied around all week about how the unrealized losses within the US banking sector approximate about $620 billion. But then, of course, we also have to bear in mind that there are trillions of value in bonds that were trading at a negative yield in 2021, and that has virtually disappeared. But what we're also can clearly see here is that it does look like it has bottomed, and the number of bonds with a negative yield is in fact increasing. It's up to about 1.5 trillion now. So a good many of those are probably in Japan, but it does behoove us to remember that the vast majority of the bonds that had negative yields were in Japan, the EU, and Switzerland. And that it wasn't just sovereign bonds, it was also corporate bonds. So that anyone who was buying those bonds between 2019 and 2021 is underwater. And now the only question is, are they going to be able to hold them to maturity and minimize their loss? Because obviously they were paying more than par if they were buying at a negative yield. So that would minimize their loss if they hold to maturity. If they sell now, well, then they're going to take a significant hit. Now, when we have the Nasdaq putting in an upside weekly key reversal against a background where we have a lot of uncertainty, particularly around the outlook for Credit Suisse. Now, the Swiss National Bank last night came through and provided 50 billion in assistance. So, Credit Suisse is going to borrow that from the National Bank. And there is speculation that there will be a marriage, it'll be a shotgun wedding between Credit Suisse and UBS, except that neither of those parties want that. And obviously, there is another big question: is will that be enough money? And the big point, of course, is that everyone is of the opinion that at Credit Suisse, its issue is not a liquidity issue, and therefore, putting more money into the bank, if it's not a liquidity issue, well, that's not going to solve the problem. It's a confidence issue that they've already fired one group of executives and replaced them. Now it looks like they're going to have to fire the new ones too. And there's just been a terminal pattern of mismanagement within the bank. But it was well off the low in here today, but it didn't hold all of the gain. And I think that it does just bring us back into a very familiar territory. Crises in the past have been solved with infinity. So when it came to the sovereign wealth crisis in the Eurozone in 2012 through 14, you had the chairman of the ECB come out and say, "We'll do whatever it takes." And then when we had the repo crisis in the USA a couple of years ago, then the Federal Reserve basically made unlimited funds available. And since then, they've formalized a standing repo facility. Then over the weekend, they said, right, we're going to backstop all deposits. So 50 billion sounds like a lot from the Swiss National Bank, but when what we're really looking at now is dealing in infinities. And that really does bring to the fore the I think the conclusion that the vast majority of investors have drawn. And it is that every time we get the size of the Fed's balance sheet contracting, it leads to an economic threat. And the solution to that threat is to at least double the size of the balance sheet. And it's not like this is the first time. So we've had other, almost exactly the same circumstances. The first time was in 2008. We had the size of the Fed's balance sheet at about 830 billion, and then it topped out at 2.25. And then over the next period of time, the size of the balance sheet went down a bit, and from that low at 1.9, it went up to 2.8. Not quite a double, but then in 2012, around the 2.8 level, it went to about 4.5. So not quite a double either, but certainly a very large increase, and definitely doubled and then more than doubled in 2020. So now we have another period of contraction, and investors, having learned the lessons over the last 15 years, are drawing the clear conclusion that it doesn't really matter how bad the economy gets or how deep the stresses are in the banking sector, because the response when it does break upon the wider economy will be that the Federal Reserve will cut interest rates back to zero, and then they will flood the market with unlimited funds in order to preserve the economic expansion. So that's the conclusion, and that is the primary reason why risk on assets are starting to do better in here today. That investors are looking at the playbook for the last 15 years and concluding this is not really all that different. Of course, the counter argument is that we now have inflation and that inflation isn't really going anywhere, and wages have been popping on the upside, and we're still at full employment, and a lot of people have retired over the course of the last couple of years. In fact, I think the pandemic was an accelerant, and it brought to the fore lots of problems that had been brewing in the past, whether that is on the social front, on the government finances front, or on the geopolitical front. The pandemic has been an accelerant, and it's certainly been an accelerant in terms of demographic change, where it accelerated the retirement plans of the baby boomer generation, and it accelerated the family formation home buying plans of the millennials, who are now the largest demographic. But then let's just think about some of these longer term ratios, because they might give us an additional clue. Let's think, and I think that the Dow Gold ratio has the most history, and it's certainly worth keeping an eye on. But I kind of think that the Nasdaq Gold ratio is more relevant. And the thing that I find most interesting is that it is still a reasonably consistent trend overall. And we have a sequence of ranges, and each one is above the last. But now it is now testing the region of the upper side of the most recent range, and it's also testing the sequence of lower rally highs. And when we just zoom in on that, over the last decade, we're really at a very pivotal point, because having bounced from support, and it is back testing the region of the 1,000-day moving average. There was only one occasion when it dropped below it in the last 15 years, and that was during the pandemic, and then not for very long. So, and then of course, subsequently, we had this really phenomenal advance where the ratio just about doubled. So, the Nasdaq doubled relative to the price of gold, and then subsequently underperformed over the last year and unwound a lot of it. And that, I think, is the other big reason why investors are willing to give the benefit of the doubt to the more technology-focused portion of the market, because there's the basic assumption that the pandemic was a one-off, and it has subsequently been unwound, and a lot of the stock prices have made the return journey to give or take around where they were in 2019, and earnings will eventually fall back to probably around where they were in 2019, or maybe a bit higher than that. But that companies have improved their margins by raising prices in the meantime. So maybe those margins are sustainable at somewhat higher levels, although I suspect not at the record levels that they have achieved over the last couple of years. And therefore, maybe this isn't a bad time to be buying if one does believe that we are heading towards significantly lower interest rates and greater monetary accommodation. And of course, thinking about that, when the US government decides they're going to backstop every deposit and that banks aren't going to be allowed to go bust, well, that's expensive. And it's generally inflationary when the answer to a problem is print money in an environment where we already have inflation. So bond yields have not continued to compress, but I suspect that they will compress from here. And then we should also pay attention to the kind of talk that was going on in the ECB today. So the ECB raised rates by 50 basis points, and they didn't say that they're going to continue to raise rates. They didn't really give any indication of what's next, but what they did do was state that they felt that they had to raise rates because to do otherwise would cause panic. And it really brought to mind that central banks, they really only start into a hiking process because they're trying to defend their credibility against inflationary pressures. And or they start hiking because they feel they have to because the economy is overheating. And then they keep doing that and they try to support the view that they're in control until there's clear evidence of stress in the wider economy. Well, banks failing because of the losses they've taken on government bonds is certainly a reason to pay attention. So central banks are beginning to think about how they can exit this hiking strategy, but that they have to give clear signaling and they don't want to appear to panic. But the bond market is pricing it in already. So there's been a fairly significant loss of momentum on the 10-year in the EU, and also we have that loss of momentum and the swift pullback in US Treasuries. And the euro, having pulled back sharply yesterday, was a bit steadier in here today. And it's firming from the 106 area, 105 area, and firming from the region of the 200-day moving average. The widening interest rate differential in favor of the dollar was the primary reason why the euro was trending down in such a profound manner in 2021 and 2022. Well, now we're in a situation where that interest rate differential has pretty much been eroded. And that was why the euro rallied between October and February. So now the question, of course, is which one of those central banks is going to start cutting rates and increasing supply first? And I think the balance of probabilities is that it will be the USA, that the Federal Reserve, with its penchant for unlimited sizes of assistance, is going to depress the dollar over time. So, of course, that is helping to support gold. And gold prices were pretty much unchanged in here today, but coming back up into the region of the high from back in January. Now, I think that it is likely we're going to see a 25 basis point interest rate hike for in the USA for exactly the same reason that the ECB did it today, that they don't want to spook the market by cutting rates. But we also have the other side of that argument, that high yield spreads are marching higher. And they're up to 555 basis points right now. And that's a pretty impressive reversal from the contraction that we had just 6 weeks ago. So high yield spreads were kind of the missing ingredient for a recession. And we also know that banks are going to be a bit more reticent to lend out a lot of money when there's so much uncertainty about where interest rates are and the relative security of bank balance sheets. So then there are going to be lots of companies that were issuing floating rate debt. And this was a point that Jeff Gundlach was making on CNBC yesterday, was that the floating rate side of the market is perhaps the most problematic. And I think that basically makes sense. Interest rates have gone up an awful lot already, and particularly for those that higher yield portion of the market. Now, the yield curve spread was a little bit wider in here today, down 14 basis points. So this, I think, is also, one of the reasons why investors are willing to give the benefit of the doubt to the upside. It's when central banks begin to aggressively cut rates in response to sharply weaker economic activity. That's usually when the stock market rolls over. So central banks are not forced to cut rates yet. Instead, they are still raising rates because they're trying to still combat inflation. And we're still in that quiet phase between when tight conditions eventually translate into higher unemployment and much tighter financial conditions. So we're not quite there yet. And in the meantime, asset prices can continue to rally from here. Now, there is the additional tailwind for technology in that you have the CEO and founder of Taiwan Semiconductor basically saying that globalization is dead and that reshoring and efforts to curtail China's economy are the right thing to do. And the Philadelphia Semiconductors Index popped on the upside today and is leading the Nasdaq higher. And of course, that's very much on the back of a new source of demand. That there's the potential that a major competitor could get knocked out, which would be Taiwan, and that the only place to buy chips then would be from manufacturing capacity around the world. So there's going to be investment in duplication. Now, that's not efficient. It means that in the event that China does not invade Taiwan, there's going to be an absolute massive surplus of equipment. But in the event that China does invade, then the investments that are going to be put in would be fruitful. So it's beneficial for the infrastructure part of the semiconductor sector. But until there's actually a war breaks out, the net price of the products produced is probably going to come under pressure. And that will also help to remove some of the inflationary pressures. But there's no question that this is a big upward dynamic. And we give the benefit of the doubt to the most recent dynamic until it is countermanded. Now, then let's also just continue to monitor oil prices because the price was off the low in here today, up a dollar. So it's quite oversold in the short term. And now $80 is a potential area of resistance, having previously been an area of support. And I think that we're going to get a fair bit of bobbing around, and that's very much in line with just waiting to see what happens in terms of interest rates and also waiting to see how the banking sector eventually does settle down. But the occupancy of commercial property is still fairly low. In fact, the occupancy of towers or commercial office blocks is pretty much where it was during 2009. So in the aftermath of the crash in 2008 and large numbers of companies going bust and a huge surge in unemployment, well, that's kind of where the commercial property market is now, and we haven't even started a recession yet. And Goldman was in negative territory today. It has steadied in the region of the 1,000-day moving average, and it was in positive territory and oversold in the short term. We could easily get a rebound in here. But the thing that is very much at the back of my mind is that asset management has been the growth driver for the company, and the asset management portion of Goldman has been where a lot of hedge funds outsourced their hedging strategy to. So there was sort of a Faustian pact that hedge funds that were better at there, I guess when we think about an asset management business, there are three different strands to an asset management business. The first is raising assets. The second is managing the upside, and the third is managing the downside. So, for funds that were better at topic number one, raising assets, well, then and perhaps not that good at the third, which would be securing themselves on the downside, well, they outsourced it to Goldman. And in return for a fat chunk of the asset management fee, Goldman provided alternative investment advice and portfolio strategy. And when we are talking about not millions, but billions, tens of billions, or even hundreds of billions, well, where does that money go? You can't put that into a piece of timber, and it's very hard to put it into small businesses. So a lot of that money gets invested in commercial property. And commercial property is really under duress right now. So these are, I think, significant issues. There's a lot of hedge that has been tied up with Goldman, and the share is rolling over. Now, it has not yet broken down, and it could easily rally over the course of the next week or two. But high yield spreads are rising, floating rate debt is in trouble, and then because of these problems in the banking sector, lending activity is going to also become problematic. So we are definitely seeing a little bit of look through from the Nasdaq. And Visa today bounced from the region of the 200-day moving average. And then MasterCard is also steadier in here. So certainly, there is a temptation to think right now that a soft landing is still achievable. I really think that that is unlikely, but markets are beginning to price it in again on the assumption that the response from regulators and government and central banks is so swift these days that it's simply not giving the market time to actually roll over, because the response in terms of liquidity is so swift. But that also is going to impair the battle against inflation. And we might be in a similar situation to that experienced by the Bank of England, where they had dislocations within the pension system. They put the money into the system necessary to curtail those risks, and then the Bank of England kept raising rates. So the market's also pricing in the potential that the 25 basis point hike next week is probably the last one. And in the event that that is not the case, well, we're definitely then going to see a resumption of the downtrends. So we're still in a tense environment, but the upper dynamics we're seeing are certainly something that is confirming a return to demand dominance. And then there's also the fact that Bitcoin is closing in again on this 25,000 level, and that is the upper side of what has been a 9-month base formation. So if it can improve upon that performance, well, that would be very clear evidence as well that liquidity measures are easing and that money is flowing back into speculative assets. So there is the potential that we're towards, or we've already found a low, and that there is a recovery underway in risk appetite. But it is basically based upon the assumption that we're in the best of all possible worlds, and that inflationary pressures are simply going to evaporate without any economic consequences. And that does appear to be, I think, Pollyanna-ish, but at the same time, the other thing that I guess I'm hesitant to reach all to rely on those upper dynamics simply because it seems to me to be an example of the Heisenberg uncertainty principle, that the more you know about the trend, then the less you know about the sustainability of it. And I think that having had 15 years of examples where central banks attempted to contract the size of their balance sheets and then created economic trouble and subsequently had to double the size of those balance sheets, well, now that we have inflation, we at least have to have a second thought as to whether they're going to be able to do that. Because the potential is a much higher inflation rate, and I mean, we already have a clear example of what that activity does in Argentina, where they've raised rates to, like, I can't remember the exact figure, but it's around 70%, and the annual inflation rate is running at 100% right now. So that's a picture of what we can anticipate if they don't get in control of inflation. And it does, I think it is something that we need to pay attention to, particularly as we head towards more interest rate hikes, or at least one last one in the next week. And I think with that, I'll leave you for today, and I'll wish all the best to all of you.